The Reformation in England differed radically from that of either Germany or France or Geneva, Switzerland, on the continent. And the reason for it is the peculiar political situation which existed in England during the 16th century. During the middle of the 15th century, there broke out in England the War of the Roses between the Lancaster, House of Lancaster and the House of York. This was finally settled by the victory of Henry VII on the field of battle, the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485, when he seized the throne as a result of his victory. But he won the throne not necessarily because of right. Well, he had some right, but not enough to warrant his being king. The result was that he established what we call the House of Tudor, or the Tudor period. And he became Henry VII. But he never felt easy on the throne. He knew that he had to have an heir. So he ruled well, but with a strong hand. He put down the rebellious nobles and instituted what was known as the Court of Star Chamber. And you may have heard of what people say when they don't like what a court does, they call Star Chamber proceedings. Have you ever heard that phrase?
I have.
Yeah, well, it comes from Henry's court, the Star Chamber, where he did away with the usual proceedings, legal proceedings, legal restrictions, in order to put down the rebellious nobles. Now, it was a high-handed method, but it did bring to England what it hadn't had for a long time, namely order, political order. Henry VII was extremely able. But during his lifetime, he brought about a marriage contract between his son, his oldest son, Prince Arthur, and Catherine of Aragon, who was a daughter of the Aragon rule, of Ferdinand and Isabella. Unfortunately, Arthur departed this world. And so Henry was left with a marriage contract, and so he called upon they married Henry VIII to Catherine. And in 1509, when Henry VII died, Henry VIII became King of England. He too lacked what we might call a legitimate claim to English throne. Therefore, he was very, very insistent that he have a male heir. And he was not particularly enamored with Catherine of Aragon, but he treated her nicely and apparently loved her with a degree of love. But by the 1525, 1526, when he could no longer, when she could no longer produce a male heir, but only stillborn, or worse, a daughter, Henry was in dire straits. He had to have a male heir. Now, I'm not defending male Henry for having the roving eye. And he undoubtedly had fallen in love, temporarily, with Anne Boleyn. And so he demanded a divorce from Catherine of Aragon. But I pointed out to you in a previous lecture that unfortunately for Henry, Catherine of Aragon was the aunt of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. And Charles had very strong feelings about divorce in general and about anybody divorcing his aunt in particular. He was rather strong-minded about it. And so when Henry approached the Pope for a divorce, Clement VII, Charles let it be known to the Pope in no uncertain terms that if he granted the divorce, it would be the last act he would do on this earth. And Clement at the Medici was not stupid, even if he was immoral. And so he became extremely moral, unbearably moral, and said, "I will not grant that divorce," period. With Charles V breathing over his shoulder, telling him what to say. Well, Henry had already made Anne pregnant and was in a dilemma. So at that time, there was a young, very able, time-serving politician in the royal entourage. His name was Thomas Cranmer. And Thomas Cranmer was a student of canon law. And so he went through canon law and he found out that Julius had made a serious error in granting a dispensation for Henry to marry Catherine, since Catherine had been betrothed to Arthur. And On that basis, after a great deal of haggling, Thomas Cranmer was made Archbishop of Canterbury. And that position, he was able to grant, not as the book textbooks say, a divorce to Henry, but to grant an annulment. You see, under canon law, if you were illegally married, then you were not legally married. Thus, you don't need a divorce, because divorce is a legal act which separates a legally married couple. But an annulment says the thing was wrong to begin with. Now, Henry was very grateful to Thomas Cranmer for this brilliant act, and he made him Archbishop Canterbury. Now, at this time, because Henry had had the trouble with Rome, and because Clement got so awfully moral and painstakingly moral, what happened was that Henry then simply had a separation from the Church of Rome. Of course, Clement had excommunicated him to boot. And so I'm bringing together facts in a rather brief treatment to let it be known what I'm up to. What happened was simply this, that Henry intended to have an English Catholic Church under his own leadership. He had Parliament pass in 1534 the Act of Supremacy, which made him the Pope of the Church in England. Well, this didn't go over too well with a lot of English Catholics, and Sir Thomas More and others were promptly executed for raising questions about this problem. And but Henry carried out his policy. And you have an English Catholic Church. All the time, you say, I am a loyal Catholic. I am a loyal Catholic. Anyone who suggested he wasn't got the axe or the hang. And a lot of people had questions about it. They got the axe. Literally. But he had Parliament pass the Six Articles Act, which reaffirmed the basic Roman Catholic positions. However, but the secret of the Roman Catholic Church, or one of them, the great secrets of its strength, is this, that the bishop of Rome, the Pope, could call in the apostolic succession, that he was the literal successor in time and place to Peter, who was the first bishop of Rome. It became more and more difficult to prove that Henry was the bishop of Rome. In fact, it was impossible, logistically and logically, biblically, and every other way. And so, to maintain the Church of England as a loyal Roman Catholic Church in doctrine, with an English head and with the king in its head, was in opposition to Innocent III, Boniface VIII, Gregory VII, Galatius II, and whatnot. it was an opposition to canon law and to the whole thrust of papal history and claims. But Henry was not one to let those things bother him. I might just say here in passing, to understand the English Reformation, you have to have a more adequate understanding than Warner Brothers provided in that great film, Henry VIII. Very entertaining, but not to the point. Henry, the tutors to the man, or to the women, from Henry VII, Henry VIII, Edward VI, Mary, and then Elizabeth. They ruled from 1485 to 1603. Had ability. Whatever else you say about them, they exuded ability. The Tudors were extremely able people. They had to be. Henry, if he hadn't had ability, could never have done what he did. Kenneth Picton, one of the great English constitutional historians, said this about him. He said he had the great ability to know what he wanted to do, and then to persuade the English people that they wanted him to do what he had wanted to do. Now, this can make a man a tyrant with popular approval, or it can make him a great man with popular approval. Henry VIII is an enigma in some ways. He was a man of ability. Part of the pressure on him was due to the fact that the Tudor house was insecure, and he was technically correct in demanding a male heir. He realized that to have a female heir at that time in history would jeopardize the Tudor monarchy. And so he demanded a male heir. Catherine couldn't provide it, so he'd get somebody to work. Now, this is technically true. It is also technically true that Anne was pregnant. And also, he was separated from Catherine. Now, to be fair to him, he always treated Catherine very nicely. He did not behead her. He didn't have her put to death. And she lived in a degree of dignity from that time on. Which I would say proved that he did have a real affection for her, if not love. She had been forced on him by his father and by Ferdinand and Isabel as a marriage to bring a union political agreement between Spain and England against France. That was the political background. Now, to do this, Henry faced an impossible task. As I said, you could not for a long time maintain a Roman church, Roman in doctrine, in an English setting with Henry as Pope. I'm not for the moment now talking about his character. Even if Henry had been an exemplary Christian character, to maintain the purity of Roman doctrine under English auspices was, in my opinion, impossible. I say it for this reason, that while England was not connected with the continent, movements in the continent did make their way to England. Now, they made their way, say 20 or 30 years later, but they did get there. And by 1525, Lutheranism, we know, had made its way to England. William Tyndale and Miles Coverdale were translating the scriptures, and heresy was rearing its ugly head in English sectors. There's no doubt that Lutheranism and Coverdale and Clove and Tyndale were appealing to segments of the English population. Some scholars hold that the movement of John Wycliffe, the Lollards, was still in existence, and they became the immediate followers of Coverdale and Tyndale. I hold this position. I realize that there's argument on the other side, but the point is that you see, when Henry separated from Rome, all the Roman authority in England vanished, and the old methods of having the Inquisition, the old methods of having the priesthood find out heresies, was still there, but it was weakened because it was not under papal control. And when you separate from the papacy, you invite a certain amount of heresy. You invite a certain amount of papal insubordination. And this was inescapable. At the same time, Henry brought this movement to bear, which undermined papal authority tremendously. It forbade the payment of annates. It forbade the appeals to the papal courts. In other words, the papacy as a power was completely shut out from English affairs by the Acts of Parliament and by the fact that England had a new head of the church, namely Henry VIII. Married Pope, to be sure, with illegitimate children and legitimate children, but nevertheless, inevitably, the movement was ripe for England to join the Reformation. Now, they passed the Act of 1536, the Six Articles Act. They passed a later act, the 12 Articles Act, to shut out heresy. But it was like putting your finger on the dike when the dike had broken down all around you. And by 1540, Cranmer had not advertised the fact, but he had changed from Roman Catholicism over into Lutheranism and was refashioning his own thinking, the liturgy for the Church of England, and certainly his own theological position. Now, no one knows, least of all do I, the exact date when Luther became a Calvinist.
When who became a Calvinist?
Oh, I meant when Cranmer became a Calvinist. Cranmer made a transition from Roman Catholic theology to Lutheran theology over into Calvinistic theology. There's no doubt that by 1549 he had made the transition. Now, most history textbooks do not reflect the true Henry VIII. I did a dissertation at one time for a degree, a 50,000 word work on the letters of Henry VIII. I went through all the letters of Henry VIII from from his letters to Anne, his letters to Catherine, his letters to the heads of state, others to the heads of state, his discussions with Cranmer, all that a man, the letters and papers of Henry VIII. Tremendous piece of work, and it took me a whole semester to do it. It was only really an advanced term paper. Now, when you do that, you see that Henry could be vindictive, you see he could be cruel, you could see he could be very loving. He was a strange mixture. He was also a true patriot. And you also see all three, a man of tremendous ability. You see a man who was immoral, and yet who in his immorality, whose immorality was a kind of a controlled immorality. Generally speaking, for political purposes. Not necessarily wanton. As far as I could tell, he did have a roving eye, but his roving eye was always sort of governed by the blinders put on by the political situation. And so we need to keep this in mind. There's no doubt that Anne Boleyn was unfaithful to him. And even though he had been, in a sense, a guilty of adultery when he married her and had gotten her pregnant, and of course that offspring was Elizabeth. I mean Mary, excuse me. Bloody Mary. And he married Anne Boleyn. And then, due to political circumstances, he needed an alliance with German Lutheran princes. So he sent Thomas Cromwell over to Germany to marry the daughter of the Duke of Cleves. And he, sight unseen, Thomas brought her back, and he had very bad taste. And Henry took one look at her and shipped her home. And beheaded Thomas Cromwell. And that ended the short alliance with the German Lutheran princes. Well, then disaster struck. Then he had to marry somebody else, and he married Catherine Howard. And she was of the very, very important Howard family, and he was trying to get the support of the Howard family. It was later the same man in that family who helped to defeat the Spanish Armada in 1588, so that they were one of the most important families in England. And in order to secure their support against other families, he married Catherine. She proved to be guilty of adultery, and of course, he dispatched her to an early grave. And in the meantime, he was becoming very, very fond of and very loyal to Thomas Cranmer. Now, I do not know, and nobody knows, really, the letters do not reveal Henry's any intimate knowledge of Cranmer's theological changes. Whether I can't tell, when I read this letter, I could not tell whether it was due to theological ignorance on the part of Henry, or whether he simply was so fond of Thomas Cranmer that he was not going to let it out what he knew. Now, I say it for this reason. When the Privy Council got to know of Cranmer's change of heart, they plotted to kill him. And they formed a plot to have him put to death. And somebody told Henry about it. And Henry was incensed. And so, at the next meeting of the Privy Council, he named Thomas Cranmer to preside in his place. But before he sent him to the council meeting, he took off the royal insignia ring and put it in Thomas Cranmer's finger. Now, Thomas Cranmer, he did not tell Cranmer what was going on. And so Cranmer held the council meeting and sat down, and the members of the Privy Council saw that insignia ring on the Cranmer's finger. The meeting adjourned. It would have been death to any council member to in any way interfere with Thomas Cranmer. Now, I don't know. I've never been able to find out whether Henry was defending Calvinism at that time or simply a very great personal friend. I don't know. Cranmer was a man of great loyalty, and he did serve the king faithfully as his chief confidant and as the archbishop, because he would talk to the Archbishop Cranmer about many things besides purely religious matters. In the meantime, Henry had built up a great deal of popular strength, because you may remember, after he became the head of the church, he seized and suppressed all the monasteries. And he raided them of all their jewels, all their wealth, and dispensed it to the people. He built hospitals, he gave it up, and he built up a popular following on the basis of distributing the wealth of the monasteries. And he did many other popular things. Even though he ruled with an iron hand at times and put people to, at the same time, he had this uncanny ability, a la Roosevelt, to say, now, this is what you want me to do. He didn't put that right, but he said, I am going to do this, and this will do this and this and this and this and this, and this will free you from the Roman guilt. This will do this and this. And you know, the people believed him. Now, it was true that at times he deceived them, but oftentimes he was telling the truth, and he told them what we're doing, and he did it. He was very forthright at times. The result was that even though the Catholics were violently opposed him, both in England and out, he was building up a popular following. After all, when you distribute the wealth to the monasteries, and the people had resented the monastic wealth, the monasteries had owned about 30% of the land of England, and it was untaxable. Therefore, on the landowners and on the burghers, on the city class, the taxation was doubled. See, if they paid a third, and the monasteries paid a third, or didn't pay a third, it meant that each of the other classes would have to pay one half of the, or the 40% that the monasteries didn't pay. So it put 50% more taxation on the burghers, the shopkeepers, the rising industry, and so on. So this was a very popular move to do this, a very popular. So this is why I'm in a mystery. I know that Cranmer came. He wrote a book on the liturgy, which is it became Calvinistic. Hunch is that by 1540 he'd become Calvinistic. But this, if Henry knew it, it didn't diminish his love and affection for him. Because before his death, he appointed Cranmer as the spiritual advisor and trainer and overseer for the young Edward VI. Even as he appointed Lord Somerset, the Calvinist, to be his political protector. So young Edward, before Edward died, was being trained for the priesthood, the kingship, politically by Lord Somerset, that represents a very powerful family, and by Cranmer, the most powerful ecclesiastical man in England. If you would ask me for something not authoritative, I would say that Henry certainly had inkling of what was going on. Because when he appointed Somerset was anathema to the Roman authorities, and Cranmer was cordially hated by them. And it wasn't because Cranmer was an unlovely man. It wasn't. He really was a very peaceful, kind-hearted, brilliant man. He never wrote theology, but he... You have a question?
No.
You know, he wrote the prayer book for the Church of England. And as its linguistics, its language is unsurpassed, except by the King James Version. Of course, the King James Version comes out of that whole milieu. When you think of the prayer book, you think of Thomas Cranmer, but it's Calvinistic theology on one hand and its beautiful English on the other. You can understand why it has survived so long, so loved by evangelical Episcopalians who love it. Now, this is the background. Henry died almost immediately. Well, young Edward assumed the throne. He got the Parliament was called the Convocation, and they authorized what became the 42 Articles Act and the First Prayer Book. Cranmer and others drew up the 42 Articles Act, which made the Church of England officially a Calvinistic church. And the prayer book put those doctrines into the form of the liturgy. The prayer book was revised under Elizabeth, and Elizabeth had the 42 Articles Act reduced to 39 Articles Act, but the Calvinistic content was retained. And in the revisions of the prayer book, the Calvinistic content was maintained. So the basic theology of the Church of England remained unchanged. But now to go to Edward contracted early in life what we believe now to be tuberculosis. He died after reigning 6 years. He ruled from 1547 to 1553. In that 6 year period, England was transformed. It became a reformed church, and Calvin so acknowledged it, as he had a tremendous regard for Cranmer and what Cranmer had done. And even in 1618, at the Council of Dort, the Synod of Dort in the Netherlands, that Reformed Synod invited representatives of the Church of England because they recognized it to be a Calvinistic church. Now, Edward died. he was the son of Jane Seymour. I didn't go through all of Henry's lives, but Jane Seymour was of the very famous, very able, and very high-minded Seymour family. There was a series of families, the Howard family, the Seymour family, and families like that, who were very high in the political, the social, and the intellectual life of England. And Jane Seymour became Henry's bride after the rather quick departure of Catherine Howard, who followed the abrupt departure of Anne of Cleves, who followed the abrupt departure of Anne. And so Jane Seymour died in childbirth in giving birth to Edward VI. And so Edward died in 1553, and Mary, the daughter of Henry and Catherine, came to the throne. She was known as Bloody Mary. She had married Philip II of Spain, who was the son of Charles V of Germany. You remember Philip II, right?
Holy Roman.
The Holy Roman. Yes. Yeah. Now, Philip had married her at the behest of the powers to have her bring the Church of England back in the Roman fold. She reigned 5 years, and the result was the flight of most of the bishops, the flight of the Marian bishops into Geneva. And that's when John Knox made his way to Geneva. In other words, the very thing that they didn't intend, the Lord worked out. So when these bishops fled England, they went to Geneva to be thoroughly trained under Calvin, for he welcomed them. But in the meantime, Cranmer, of course, did not flee. And Cranmer and Latimer and Ridley were burned to the stake. And if you read the contemporary accounts, this was the general evaluation, that as many as Calvin was able, I mean, Cranmer led the Lord by his work in the church, was far exceeded by the number he converted by his death. See, before his death, he had gone through a form of recantation, fearing burning by the stake, and then he realized that he betrayed his Lord, and so he asked for permission from Queen Anne if he could give one last testimony, but he didn't tell her what he was going to do. What he did was to recant his recantation, and while the flames were licking out and burning his hands, his feet, and covering his face with the smoke and so on, he burst forth in a loud voice, calling upon Christ, his Savior, and asking him forgiveness forever, denying his Lord, and bowing abject and humiliation because he'd done, and preaching the gospel as his voice came up from among the flames. Mary was furious, but there's nothing she could do about it. So his death was so glorious that not even Froude, the English historian, who had no use for Cranmer or no use for the gospel, said that Mary seals her fate and the fate of the Roman Church in England when she burned Cranmer and when she sent all these bishops over to Geneva. Because in 1558, when she died, the daughter of Henry and Anne Boleyn came to the throne. Elizabeth had led a precarious life. If you read her life, you'll find out that there are constant plots by the Catholics to assassinate her. And the result was, while she was not very friendly to the Catholic Church. And the result was, she realized that Europe and England could not go on in this divided state. And so I'm eclipsing a lot of history, but I'm trying to give the background to Westminster Assembly. She sought what she called the we are media, the middle way, middle between the Calvinistic approach to worship, doctrine, and so on, and the Roman Catholic system. A very delicate tightrope she was going to walk. However, her first two archbishops were thoroughly Calvinistic, so in doctrine she maintained Calvinism. But she also passed acts in which the Puritans were severely restricted. I should have pointed out that in the reign of Elizabeth, I cannot give you an exact date when it began, but a great Puritan movement broke out under the influence of Thomas Cartwright, professor of theology at the University of Cambridge. And Cambridge for years became the stronghold of Puritanism, and it turned out a veritable stream of great theologians, most of the Puritan leaders of England, with which you're familiar, were graduates of Cambridge University. It became a hotbed of Puritanism. But they were put under severe ecclesiastical restrictions as to where they could preach and so on. And the result was, there was a strong Puritan movement, a protest within the Church of England. This protest took three forms. The first form was the was what we call the Puritan Presbyterian movement. Those who wanted to form a Presbyterian church to separate entirely from the Church of England and establish a Presbyterian church. These were the strictest, but they were very strict. Then there were the Congregational Puritans. Then the next were the real Puritans who wished to reform the Church of England, stay within it and reform it. They took the leadership under Whitgift and Parker, the archbishops of those days. The third group, later known as the Brownist movement at times, were really the early Baptists and the Congregationalists. There were really two groups that for time combined. But they wanted to separate from the Church of England, but to become independent. They were the independent Puritans, or really, in this country, they became the pilgrims when they came to this country. You have the Presbyterian Puritans who wanted to establish a Presbyterian church. You had the Puritan Puritans who wanted to reform and purify the Church of England of all the excrement of the Roman system, to do away with the high service, to do away with the vested clergy, to do away with the remnants of the Mass, to do away with the high altar and so on. In other words, to cleanse the church entirely of all the remaining elements of the Roman Catholic system. Now, the Presbyterians agreed with that, but they didn't think they could do it in the church. They wanted to form a Presbyterian church. Now, the Congregationalists also wanted to do that, but they realized they could not do it in the established church. So they established independent congregations, out of which movement came ultimately the Baptist movement, both in England and in this country.
And the Congregationalists?
Yes, the Baptists and the Congregationalists. They originally known as the Brownist movement under Robert Brown in the 1580s.
Clear to me what the difference was between their movement and the Presbyterian.
Well, the difference was that the Presbyterians wanted a Calvinistic system of church government, that is, the Presbytery. In other words, they were not independents. They did want independence from the Church of England, but they wanted an established denominational connectionalism.
Okay.
Now, on the other hand, the Congregationalists wanted a looser form.
The church government was.
Yes. Now, with the Baptists, it was all church government and baptism. The baptism of believers only by immersion. But these early Baptists were Calvinists. The Savoy Confession of Nice Doctrine make that very clear. They were roughly equivalent to John Gill later, and to the people who adopted the Bold Confession of Faith and the American Baptist movement.
Spurgeon.
Pardon me?
Spurgeon.
Spurgeon. Yeah. He was later than Gill. He was 19th century. Spurgeon would represent this group. John Gill, there are many other through the ages who represent him. Now, Elizabeth then had a hard time in the whole. She had great ability, uncanny ability. And I should have mentioned that when Mary died, Philip II was left without a wife. And so from 1558 to 1589, 88, he courted her for 30 years. There were all sorts of plots swirling around her head, and she finally had to have Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, put to death. And then when Philip finally caught on that she wasn't going to marry him, he got sort of peeved, and he sent the Spanish Armada against her. And when she defied, that was defeated under Lord Admiral Howard, Philip's hope for marriage went down the drain in the North Sea, or the English Channel. In 1603, Elizabeth died. There's a great period of English history, of great literature, great drama, great theological development, largely from the Puritans, along with Thomas Cartwright, the professor at the Cambridge, they did tremendous work. This is when they did their great writing. Now, Elizabeth died without heir. Now, what would they do? Well, Henry VIII had married his daughter Margaret into the royal house of the Stuarts of Scotland. Political prestige, political strength, and so James the Sixth of Scotland, the grandson of this union, the daughter of Mary Stuart, the son of Mary Stuart, was the next in line to be the King of England. And so in 1603, he became King of England and established the Stuart dynasty. Now, you see, the Stuart dynasty was really, through the marriage alliance with the Stuart house, was really a continuation of the Tudor blood flowed through from Mary Queen of Scots and her mother and grandmother down into James the First of England. He'd been James the Sixth of Scotland, he became James the First of England. Now, James again had an obsession, and that was what we call Stuart absolutism. In essence, it was this: I rule by the king rules by divine right. When he speaks for God. He can do no wrong politically because he is God's vice regent on earth. Thus, when he speaks infallibly as a king and acts as a king, the people must follow him, period. It's not modern despotism, because James always acknowledged that he was governed by the word of God. He was not an unbeliever. The stubbornness of Henry VIII pales into utter insignificance to the stubbornness of James I. Henry VIII looks almost flexible compared to James I. He was determined to rule absolutely, and he said, Puritanism and monarchy agreeth as doeth God the devil. Which was to say, he declared war on the Puritans. Well, he was to learn that the Puritans were a little too strong to handle. Only gradually. And so, in 1611, to modify them, he called for the edition of the King James Version of Scripture. This was the olive branch which he threw out to them. And that's how it came. Briefly, that's how it came. I'm skipping a lot of history. But it was really the result of Puritan pressure on James, which brought that event around. In the textbooks, you never see that. At least no textbook I've ever seen. But the persecution, in a sense, I don't mean putting to death right away, but the rough treatment of the Puritans in England and Scotland began. And in 1625, James joined Elizabeth and his mother in death. And Charles I came to the throne. Imbued with all the political ambitions, the political philosophy of James, and in a sense more ruthless. Now on that note, I guess I better close, but dang. I shall finish this next time and take some idea of the church in this country.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."